From WIPR in Baltimore, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. Baltimore's Promise is a consortium of civic leaders from government, philanthropy, business, education, and religious institutions who are trying to address the multiple challenges faced by so many children in the city of Baltimore. There's no shortage of well-meaning people and programs aimed at improving outcomes for kids, but what programs and strategies best meet the needs of kids in a city in which nearly a quarter of them live below the poverty line? How can we best improve the journey on what's been coined the cradle-to-career continuum? Patrick McCarthy, the president and CEO of the Annie E. Casey Foundation, and Tommy Hires on Baltimore's Promise to Our Children. And for those children who love to read, a handy guide to books for early and eager readers from Kathleen Isaacs, an expert on children's lit, plus theater critic J. Wynn Russick has her weekly theater review. Maryland Morning coming right up after the news.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. Glad you can be with us. That's Maryland Morning on 88.1 WYPR. I'm Tom Hall. 4 years ago, a number of business and philanthropic leaders formed an organization called Baltimore's Promise, aimed at addressing the multiple challenges faced by so many children in the city of Baltimore. The idea is simple: bring together educators, government officials, clergy, foundation leaders, and others to gain consensus on what programs and strategies would best meet the needs of a very vulnerable population in a city in which nearly a quarter of our citizens live below the poverty line, and many others struggle with housing and food insecurity, lack of access to jobs and job training, and health care. Baltimore's Promise points to investments totaling more than $3.5 billion in 2013. That's up from $3.4 billion in 2011 to fund early childhood programs, employment assistance, and crime prevention. Since the violence that followed the death of Freddie Gray in April of last year, there's been a lot of talk about securing our children's future and addressing the issues of inequality that strangle, in particular, communities of color. With billions of dollars steered towards programs for children and youth, there's no doubt that a lot of people, some of whom control substantial resources, are ready, willing, and eager to invest those resources to improve what Baltimore's Promise calls the cradle-to-career continuum. But how best to invest those resources seems to be a very complex calculus. So to help us understand that calculus, I'm joined in the studio by Patrick McCarthy. He's the president and CEO of the Annie E. Casey Foundation and the co-chair of the board of directors of Baltimore's Promise. Tommy Hires joins us as well. She's the executive director of Baltimore's Promise. Welcome to you both. Thanks for your time.
Thanks
for having us.
So, Patrick, with all the money spent in places like Sandtown, Winchester, and when the violence that followed the death of Freddie Gray occurred last year, we heard a lot about the investments that nonprofits and the government have made in that area of town. The life expectancy in that neighborhood is still 20 years lower than it is in places like Roland Park or Homeland. Just in a general sense, what are we not doing that we should be doing?
You know, I think it's important to say that the problems that our communities face go well beyond what any particular set of programs or even investments in social services can turn around. We have to have the right context here. So we've got decades and decades of historical residential segregation. We've got decades and decades of people living in poverty, without a path to opportunity. And so the sense of hope and the sense of optimism that you would hope to pass on to your children just isn't there in lots of instances, not because families don't want the best for their children, not because families are irresponsible, but simply because they haven't had the resources or the support to be successful. So as we look at the money that has been spent in places like Sandtown, Winchester, we have to understand it in the context of the challenges that are faced by the children and families in that community. We know that housing is important. That's a very expensive area to invest in. We know that transportation is critical. We know that jobs are at the core of all of this. Baltimore's Promise is really trying to look at the months before a child is born, all the way through birth of that child to entrance into kindergarten to success in school to completing high school and getting a post-secondary credential of some type, whether that's college or a trade, all the way into a career. That's a different way of thinking than we usually do.
Yeah, that's a long-term look, isn't it?
It's a long-term look, and it is based on the premise that you can't come in the middle or come in late and have as much impact as if you're thinking strategically across the entire lifespan, because one thing leads to the next. And because if you think about it, the young people who are on the older end of that spectrum, who are getting their post-secondary credential, hopefully, or getting a job, they're the parents of the next generation. So there's a way in which you're basically trying to establish a virtuous cycle of investment.
The only other person who's going to have that kind of long-term commitment to that child, prenatal through birth through, you know, post-secondary education or training, is a parent, right? I mean, generally speaking, I mean, there'll be employers along the way. There'll be interested teachers. There'll be mentors. But the parents, the only other. So is Baltimore Promise, you know, trying to replace parenting in some fundamental way?
In many ways, it's the exact opposite. Baltimore's Promise starts from a recognition that parents are not only a key, they are the key to the success of children. And so we have to think about, what do parents need in order to do right by their kids? What resources do they need? And there are instances, of course, in which the parents' support for the child needs to be supplemented. But we want to do it in a way that builds that family up rather than replaces that family. And so that's a very important part of the work that we do.
Mm-hmm. And Tommy Hires, one of the things that you concentrate on is avoiding duplication, because there are a lot of foundations, there are a lot of very well-meaning organizations that are trying to address these problems. Are silos a problem? I mean, are people doing stuff kind of in vacuums and not really being hip to what other people are doing? Is that something that you've identified as a need?
Yeah, it's most definitely a need. I think one of the important things about our work is, although we have five outcome areas, the ones that Patrick mentioned, we're really focused on them being a continuum. So it's not simply about intervening in the life of a child and their family early. It's about intervening often and building off of those successes. So if a child is born healthy, is he or she entering kindergarten ready to learn? Are they achieving at grade level and so forth? And within each of those areas, I mean, there are a number of organizations and systems agencies like the school system or DSS who are doing
Department
work.
Of Social Services.
Absolutely,
mm-hmm.
The Department of Social Services. So it's important to understand who's doing what, where, how, and why. What if any outcomes exist as a result of that work? And sometimes those outcomes are good, but unfortunately, sometimes those outcomes are bad. So how can we collectively understand what's having an impact on the lives of these children and families? And for the things that are working well, let's shine a light on those things and make sure that more people know about it. And let's figure out how to do more than that. But more importantly, let's figure out how to connect those dots so that there is definitely continuity.
But do you find that there's a problem with duplication and this sort of silo mentality where, you know, you're in there, you're concentrating, doing your thing, and you're sort of oblivious to what other people are doing? So that, therefore, maybe those resources are being, to a certain extent, wasted in that you've got people doing the same thing.
That's definitely a challenge. And one of the things that we do through Baltimore's Promise is for each of our outcome areas, we convene working groups where we bring people together who are working in those spaces so that we can understand who's doing what and so that we can do all that we can to maximize those increasingly reduced resources that are being targeted to those outcome areas.
Tommy Hires is the executive director of Baltimore's Promise. We're joined in the studio by Patrick McCarthy. He's the president and CEO of the Annie E. Casey Foundation and the co-chair, along with Mark Lerner, of Baltimore's Promise. So, Patrick, is consensus hard among the people that you have on your board? You have some of the great community leaders in this town who've been community leaders for a long time. Building coalitions is usually hard. Finding consensus is usually difficult. So I wonder, you know, you've got the president of University of Maryland, Baltimore on your board. You've got the chairman of T. Rowe Price on your board. Maybe they see the needs of children differently than the president of the Weinberg Foundation or Lena Nguyen, who's the city health commissioner, who's also on your board. I mean, how do you get people together on the same page?
So it's a great question. And what we've learned from other cities who have done similar kind of work is that you start with getting clear on what are the results you expect to achieve. What's the target? And reaching consensus on that was actually fairly easy. And that's why we identify these five areas. Children have to be born healthy. They have to be ready for school. They have to be succeeding in school, third grade reading and eighth grade math, graduating from high school, getting their post-secondary credential into a job. These are results that people came together on very quickly. And then you say, well, so how do you know? How are you going to measure that? We came together very quickly on that. So now we have measures and reasonable targets. And that's the point at which you start to bring in data, you bring in evidence, you do financial analysis, and you begin to drive towards consensus on what the next investment would be. There's another piece of this, though, Tom, that I just want to insert an example of how this can work. In Baltimore, actually, this is a number of years ago, but in Baltimore, there was a focus on improving school readiness. And a number of us pulled together, lots of folks who were interested in improving that simple outcome, improving school readiness at kindergarten. And the health department realized that they were sending health workers out into the homes all over the city, and they were focused on health outcomes. But they began to realize that they had an insight into those homes and into those families that others didn't, and they realized that they could bring reading materials and coaching to parents on how to read to their children for no additional cost. They were already there. That's an example of aligning the different contributions that people can make in order to achieve something.
Because these are technically health workers, but they could have an educational dimension to what they're doing. Yeah. And Tommy, this is called something, I think you call it the collective impact model. That sounds pretty fancy. What does that mean?
It means that we're stronger together than we are individually. And, you know, one of the things that we're trying to do through Baltimore's Promise is to, you know, recognize that, you know, collective power of all of these folks who are working in similar lanes, just like the example that Patrick cited with taking advantage of the presence of their health, of those healthcare workers, and getting them to focus those existing resources just a little bit differently so that we're having a broader impact on the goals that we're seeking to achieve.
I mean, the example that Patrick makes about this small sliver of the education piece, education is just so complicated. I mean, there's the school system, there's a political dimension to that, there's parents, there's, you know, limited resources, both from the Department of Education, the Baltimore City Public Schools, and the mayor's office and the city budget at large. I mean, how do you address that with all these different players?
I think for the most part, all these players have the same goal. They want these kids to achieve and to have positive outcomes in school. So whether it is third grade reading or eighth grade math or all the way through high school graduation. Now, I'll admit, they may come to the table with their own agenda because we all have our own perspectives based upon the perch on which we sit. But in the end, it's that common goal that people have. And what's it going to take? And what resources do I have in my arsenal to contribute to that overall goal of these young people having better achievement in school? So that's what we focus on.
If you're just joining us, we're talking this morning with two of the leaders of an organization called Baltimore's Promise. It's a consortium of foundation, business, education, religious, and government leaders who concentrate on improving what they call the cradle to career continuum. Thomasina Hires is the executive director of Baltimore's Promise. Patrick McCarthy is the president and CEO of the Annie E. Casey Foundation and the co-chair of Baltimore's Promise. So, Patrick, your work with the Annie E. Casey Foundation often focuses on juvenile justice issues, child welfare, those kinds of things. Are you finding that there are folks working at cross purposes? Because sometimes that happens, that well-intentioned folks, they end up trying different things or making different approaches, and those different approaches themselves are at cross purposes. I mean, do you find that either with the Casey Foundation or with your work with Baltimore's Promise?
I don't think that's the largest part of the challenge that we face, that people literally would be working at cross purposes. It certainly is the case that people are working on different elements of the problem. There are instances in our work across the country where we may run into a different point of view. For example, in juvenile justice, where some people would be more focused on locking kids up because they think that'll make the community safe, and others will say, well, actually, it doesn't make the community safe. We should intervene in these kids'
lives.
Yeah,
so that's exactly what I'm talking about. I mean, exactly. It's just people say, okay, well, here's this problem. We all agree on the problem, but we totally disagree on how to solve it.
That's right. And the Casey Foundation's hallmark from the beginning has been to say, well, let's look at the data. Let's look at the evidence. And as we do our work, we don't stop looking at the data. We continue to look at the data to see if what we're doing works. And so in the area of juvenile justice, we've been able to demonstrate that you can greatly reduce the number of kids who are locked up. And in fact, public safety has not been negatively affected. We're in over 300 jurisdictions around the country. And so we've got the evidence to show that that works. We're now saying that it's time to close most adult-type juvenile prisons. And our perspective on that is, in fact, you can do that in a safe way, that the few kids who do need to be locked up can be incarcerated in much more humane, smaller, treatment-oriented, employment-oriented facilities, and the public will be safer because they won't be coming out of these facilities more likely to commit crime. We've got the data. We've got the evidence. We didn't have as much data 25 years ago when we started on this work, and now we do. Same with Baltimore's Promise. We need to build on the data and the evidence.
Mm-hmm. Tommy, when I talk to folks who are activists in the community, particularly in communities of color, folks like Munir Bahar, who runs the 300-Man March, or Erica Alston, who's very involved over at Santa Winchester, or Ray Kelly from the No Boundaries Coalition, obviously they are on the ground in a way that Baltimore's Promise and all of these CEOs and people who hold some very elevated positions in the business and philanthropic community can't be on the ground. Who and what drives the data? Where are you getting the data from? And are you able to maintain a connection with the folks who are on the street in places like Sandtown and Harlem Park, et cetera?
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that we try to do is to not simply be data-driven, like looking at that publicly available data that'll tell you whether or not babies are born healthy or how well children are achieving at grade level. But we also want to be data-informed. And so that's pulling on leaders to help us to understand the context of that data. What does it mean? What doesn't it mean? And having them work with us to identify not simply the challenges that are contributing to the bad outcomes, but where are the opportunities to fix it. With Baltimore's Promise, through our work groups and our action teams, we've been able to mobilize over 200 or so leaders like Benir and Erica, who are working on the ground to tell us, what's the ecosystem of mentoring programs in Baltimore City? How are they recruiting kids? How are they training their volunteers to work with children? What are some of the gaps? How can we help to build the capacity of those providers so that they can help us focus on the big outcomes that we care about? And it's very much getting the perspectives of those organizations who are working on the ground, as well as the folks who are helping to determine what the policies are so that we can be on the same page.
Tommy Hires is the executive director of Baltimore's Promise. Patrick McCarthy is the co-chair of the board of Baltimore's Promise. He's also the president and CEO of the Annie E. Casey Foundation. We're talking about improving outcomes for children in Baltimore and the various approaches to that. And so, Patrick, I mean, let me ask you the pessimist question. There's no shortage of people with great intentions, and some of them are very smart people, you know, but these problems are persisting, you know, so perniciously. I mean, the problems that we encountered when the violence broke out after the death of Freddie Gray were clearly rooted in problems that hadn't been solved from the last time there was a riot in Baltimore in the 1960s. I mean, why is it that this is such a tough nut to crack as a guy who's, you know, worrying about this and losing sleep about it every night?
Yeah. So the root of most of the problems that we see in this country for children and families, the roots go to poverty. And the roots of poverty go to lack of opportunity. So we're not going to be able to have a quick fix kind of answer. We shouldn't overpromise beyond what we can actually deliver. But we know that we have to simultaneously attack poverty at its root, that is creating opportunity, and we have to recognize you have to simultaneously invest in the family and in the child, in the parents and in the child at the same time if you're going to get better results. So the pessimism is well grounded in part because we've had these sort of fragmented solutions that we try here and there rather than a more cohesive, collaborative, comprehensive kind of approach on the one hand. And at the same time, we have to recognize that there's only so much that something like Baltimore's Promise can do without others also attacking the issues of poverty and opportunity. I'm very optimistic about Baltimore right now. I think we actually have lots of bright spots on the horizon that have to do with opportunity and with jobs. We've got to make sure that people are prepared for those jobs and can get to those jobs. And I think that's part of where Baltimore's Promise comes in.
But over the last several years, I mean, it's been close to $7 billion invested by the folks that are working with your organization. And that's a lot of money. Obviously, you want to try to get the best bang for the buck, and you're working on that, and you're looking at the data, and you're thinking about it. But boy, $7 billion, and we're still where we are.
Yeah. Well, Well, it's important for your listeners to understand that includes all of the costs of education, which is hugely expensive in a city school system. It includes all the cost of healthcare, which is very expensive. So the marginal increases that puts extra resources toward those young people who are most challenged really isn't anywhere near $7 billion. It's actually much less than that. Mm-hmm. But to be fair, if you think about it as an investor, you also want to look at what's the return. And that's where the question of what's my next investment, what should it be, and what is it going to deliver by way of results? Right now, we don't have a way of answering that question. And part of what Baltimore's Promise is about is being able to answer that question. Where should we invest next? And when we did it work? And if not, let's invest differently as we go forward. Yeah. That's what we're trying to do.
And of course, Tommy Heyer, knowing what fails is as important to know as what succeeds. I mean, because you just don't want to be throwing money down a pit that's not going to, you know, produce anything.
Absolutely.
Is there a tension between the public and private sectors on this? Because you've got folks involved in both sides in your organization. I mean, do the public and private sectors see the problems the same?
I think in general, irrespective as to whether or not issues are being tackled from a government perspective or a philanthropic perspective, people in general want to know what works. And they want to be able to invest in what's going to get the greatest return, both in terms of dollars, but also in terms of outcomes for young people. And what really, I think, makes Baltimore's Promise special is that general desire to want to better align budgetary and strategic priorities toward what works and to potentially reallocate resources away from the things that aren't getting us the kinds of returns that we want to see toward the things that will get us there. So I think they're the same in that sense.
Can you give us an example of some reallocation that's happened, say, over the last year, two, 3 years that you really identified, nope, this is not working. We got to walk away from it.
So we haven't gotten there yet, but there's a tremendous opportunity in the work. So Van Mitchell is, in addition to Lena Nguyen, a part of our board. Secretary Mitchell oversees the State Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. And in Baltimore, we're fortunate to have a comprehensive strategy, Be More for Healthy Babies, that's made tremendous progress in reducing the infant mortality rate in Baltimore City over the past 5 years. There is very little Medicaid money being directed toward this successful strategy. And what Secretary Mitchell has allowed us to do is to come in and to review the policy and funding allocations behind Medicaid so that we can understand how to begin directing some of those Medicaid resources toward this proven strategy that we think, if we were able to expand, we could do even better. So he and his team are in the process of reviewing some recommendations that we've put forth with help from Dr. Nguyen, and that could be one of those areas where a reallocation or a broader consideration of how Medicaid is applied can be demonstrated.
Again, Dr. Lena Nguyen is the city health commissioner here in Baltimore City. So, Patrick, you've got all these different work groups. You've got folks developing data, analyzing data. I wonder, is there data emerging in these last couple of years that you have found to be new, to be shocking, to be surprising? I'm thinking of a researcher at Hopkins named Stephanie DeLuca, who wrote a book about a long-term study about kids who grew up in impoverished situations. One of the myths that she tries to explode in this book is that most kids in these impoverished situations are drawn to a life on the street. They're drawn to the drug trade. They're drawn to illegal activity as opposed to the mainstream economy. Are there things that you're finding that, you know, really are turning on its head what people thought were the proper solutions and the proper approaches?
I think as we're looking at the research around the country, we are finding lots of examples that are similar to what Stephanie found in her research. People make, understandably perhaps, but they make all sorts of assumptions about what young people think or what people in poverty think. But when you actually go into the community and get to know folks, most of what you believe is usually wrong. One of the more recent studies looked at what difference it would make if poor folks had an additional $2,000 or $3,000 in their pocket in terms of long-term impact on kids. And the average person probably, they're just going to spend it on things that aren't really important, not going to make any difference in the child's education, and they're not going to spend it on their kid or whatever. Turns out that the long-term studies that have been done turn that on its head, that a little bit of additional money in a parent's pocket actually has long-term impact on the child's educational outcome, on their health outcomes, et cetera. So we're learning a lot more about the importance of basic needs for families.
So, Tommy, I mean, if the goal is to make sure every kid is healthy, well-educated as he or she enters adulthood, how do you evaluate the people and the programs that are best to do that? I mean, do you have a sort of a checklist to say, you know, okay, you're doing this, therefore it must work? How does it work?
Sure. So we have a number of core indicators that we're looking at. Population-level data that'll show us whether or not we're moving in the right direction. Are we still moving in the right direction with respect to infant mortality? Is our high school graduation numbers going up? Are kids doing better when they enter kindergarten? Are we moving from 42% to 90% on our kindergarten readiness assessment? So we have a data dashboard on our website, www.baltimorespromise.org, that shows three-year trend data of how we're doing in Baltimore compared to Maryland and whether we're moving in the right direction or not.
Can you summarize that trend for me?
Sure. For the most part, we are moving in a positive direction on some key indicators. Our high school graduation rates are up. Our unemployment rates for kids between the ages of 17 to 24, they're going down, but there are lots of areas where we can do better. Our kids are not performing well on standardized tests at third grade, at fifth grade, or eighth grade, things where we can definitely make improvement on. The recent kindergarten readiness assessment data is not showing that our kids are coming to kindergarten ready. So despite the gains that we've made over the past couple of years, what it shows us are the areas where we can definitely do better.
Mm-hmm. Patrick, we just got a few seconds left, but it sounds like, you know, you've been at this with Baltimore's Promise for about 4 years now.
Actually, started implementation just a year ago. The planning was longer than that, but started a year.
With a year of implementation, yeah. It's obviously not enough time to get the kind of data you need. Give me a time frame about when you think you'll actually know what's cooking.
Well, I think we know now. We have baseline reports that tell us where we are now. I think that we will track that data over time. We recently decided to kind of focus in on a couple of prototype projects to see if we can use this forum to make improvements in those. And I think we can probably we'll probably have more to say in another 18 months or so on that.
All right. Well, we will check back in with you then and keep tabs on all this. I appreciate both of you guys coming in. Thanks.
Great. Thank you,
Thanks
Tom.
For having us.
Patrick McCarthy is the president and CEO of the Annie E. Casey Foundation, the co-chair, along with Mark Lerner of Baltimore's Promise. Tommy Hires is the executive director of Baltimore's Promise. We've got a link to more information on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Lots more ahead. Stick around. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick joins us most Monday mornings here on Maryland Morning. She checks out the regional theater scene and lets us know what's hot and what's not. This week, Judy has been to the Theater Project in Baltimore to see a new show called Framed Illusion. Here's her review.
A windowless room, a few hardback chairs, and a table with a bare bulb overhead. A female police detective interrogates a murder suspect. The suspect is also a woman. She was arrested at a party held to celebrate a book about, and supposedly written by, a prominent but notorious man. He's identified only as the president, though whether that refers to the political or corporate world is left unsaid. Now he's been murdered. The suspect was his ghostwriter. Was she also his killer? Does she have something to hide? Does the detective? Human communication has its limitations, and when people deliberately conceal information, at a police interrogation, for example, understanding may boil down to a matter of perception. Perception, and its flaws, is the central theme of Framed Illusion. This latest work by La Petite Noiseuse Productions is premiering at the Theater Project. The one-act play is written, directed, and stars the company's artistic and scientific director, Monica Lopez Gonzalez. Scientific director isn't a term typically associated with theater, but Lopez Gonzalez isn't a typical theater artist. She's also a cognitive scientist. Framed Illusion is the concluding installment in her trilogy of plays focusing on creativity, musical improvisation, and multilingualism. Each play has two characters accompanied by live music improvised on the spot in response to the dialogue. The result is a little like chamber music, in which two of the parts are spoken. Framed Illusion has the look and feel of film noir. The furniture and clothing are mostly black. The suspect wears a cocktail dress with a skirt as silvery gray as the silver screen. Bass player Alexander R. Fournier and trumpeter Nicholas A. Sarbanes enhance the noir feeling with a score that changes with each performance, but ranges from jazz to sounds approximating a car horn, a siren, or, at one point, a cacophony of voices in the suspect's head. About halfway into the hour-long play, the balance of power shifts, and the music becomes louder and more insistent. This shift builds gradually, but it doesn't come as a surprise. From the beginning, Linda Bancroft portrays the suspect as cocky. She's not happy about the arrest, but doesn't seem overly concerned about being accused of murder. In body language and expressions, she's more at ease than the detective. Occasionally, she even laughs. In contrast, Lopez Gonzalez's detective is almost unrelentingly severe. And there's something about the way her officious character lords it over the suspect that seems a bit forced. A few other elements in the production also feel forced. At least twice, the detective makes an overt statement of the play's theme. In one case, she looks at the audience and says, "Don't you love how inconsistent our perceptions are?" Later, she tells us, "It's all about perception." The detective also delivers a near manifesto on correcting gender inequities. Themes of feminism and misogyny also figure into the play. And though the major plot twist may not be a shocker, watching the detective and suspect faint and parry holds the audience's interest as our perceptions shift and change. The previous installments of Lopez Gonzalez's trilogy were set in a cabaret and a psychiatrist's office. The multilingual component is that each was written in a different language, Spanish, French, or Italian. The first was performed with English surtitles. The dialogue in the other two is in English. For audiences attending these two, the multilingual component isn't evident. There's a sense of unreality underlying framed illusion, beginning with the word illusion in the title. Is what we're watching intended to be realistic or a metaphorical commentary on understanding and perception? For that matter, is framed illusion a work of theater or science? Maybe both. I guess it depends on what you perceive.
Theater critic J. Wynn Russick. Framed Illusion is at the Theater Project in Baltimore Thursday through Sunday. We've got a link to more information, as well as a link to my conversation with Monica Lopez Gonzalez. She was on Maryland Morning a couple weeks ago talking about her show. You can check it out at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up after a break for the news, books for eager young readers. Kathleen Isaacs is an expert on children's literature. She's written a compendium of books that kids who love to read will love to read. Stay with us.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. If you're a parent or a grandparent or a doting aunt or uncle or a loving guardian of a young kid who loves to read, here's some help finding books for those kids in your life who are good at reading and who are always on the hunt for the next fun book. Kathleen Isaacs has compiled a list of 300 titles she recommends for those kids who are really readaholics. It's called Excellent Books for Early and Eager Readers, and Kathleen Isaacs joins me in the studio. Kathy, good to see you.
Good to see you too, Tom.
So you've been doing a lot of reading. There's 300 books in here, and you've written a little sort of précis about each one. I will admit that the term early and eager to define a young reader is a new one to me. Is that a special class of kid reader?
No, that's a class I made up.
Okay.
I made it up because it covers a broad range, maybe from 4 to 9 or 10. And it's the kind of kid that you always find with her nose in the book or his bag full of books or whatever.
Yeah, because there are some kids who just take to reading easier and better than others.
Yes, there are. And there's some little kids who seem to teach themselves to read, and all of a sudden you turn around and they're reading the signs to you and asking what they mean. And there are bigger kids who don't take to it so fast, but when they do, then they can make that movie in their head and get the story, and they get kind of addicted to it.
Mm-hmm. So these books really then are kind of tailored. I mean, the ones you've chosen here are tailored to those kids who really are big on reading. These are not necessarily the books, although I suppose there could be some of these, many of these books that you'd want to use to introduce the reluctant reader to. These are for kids who really are into it.
These are for kids who are really into it. They're the kind of kid who tends to read above their grade level. And so we want to challenge them, but not to give them material that's completely out of their ken. So, and this is quite a challenge both for parents and for librarians and teachers as well.
Sure, because sometimes if a kid is a good reader, the point you make in this book over and again is that sometimes the subjects are still a little too far advanced. You know, I mean, there's certain things a four-year-old might actually be able to decipher what the words are, but the meaning and the context could be a little bit too grown up.
They can decode the words always, and they can pronounce them, and they don't know what's underneath. And also, they don't have the same kind of reading background that an older person might have, an older kid or an older adult.
So putting stuff in context is a lot harder for a
yes.
6-year-old than it is for a 16-year-old.
Absolutely.
Sure. So you have taught virtually across the spectrum in terms of ages. You've taught little kids. You've taught high school. You've taught
yep.
college, graduate school. You've coached and mentored teachers. How did you go about coming up with these particular 300 titles?
Well, I asked people. I talked to parents of kids like this, and I talked to school and public librarians and some bookstore people. They gave me suggestions, and they also told me what these kids are reading today, which is really very important.
And it has evolved. It's changed.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and what are the trends? What are you seeing in that evolution?
I am seeing more and more books in the first place and a much wider range. And I think that's one of the things that I was trying to do, was to get a broader range of materials than the classics that are in your head and my head about what we liked to read when we were a kid.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe what our kids read. I mean,
absolutely.
You know, we now have kids who are adults. Mm-hmm. There's certainly been a push for much more diversity in children's literature in the last, I don't know how many years, we date when publishers all of a sudden started waking up to the fact that, oh, it would be good if, you know, people of color could look at books and see kids that look like them. You've included a lot of those in this book, haven't you?
I did that. And yes, it's no longer an all-white world of children's books, and that's a very old article now. But it is a world that where you still have to work hard to find books that represent the range of young people that we have in this country today. And so I did, especially in the chapter books, where there is a lot of publishing these days, where people make an effort to have children from all kinds of backgrounds.
Here we've talked to Paula Willey, who's a librarian in Baltimore County, mm-hmm. who comes by occasionally to talk about children's books, and even Carla Hayden from The Pratt,
yes.
who comes by and recommends books. They talk about the importance of series now. So you read one book, and then you just have this expectation that there's going to be 3, 5, 10 more in the series.
You do, and it's part of what kids are looking for. They want a book they can feel comfortable with. And one of the ways you can feel comfortable is if you already know the characters, or you have an expectation of the format, or something else. So in this book, I actually listed sequels up to 5, no more than that, because some of them have 32 or 114.
Yeah. Other examples of, what come to mind about some of the ones that are your real favorites?
Oh, my real favorites. It's very hard. When I was writing this, I was thinking about a book I read, reviewed a few years ago called Kelsey Green, Reading Queen. And Kelsey was one of those third graders who really loves to read. And her school has a contest where you have to read the most books, so she has to go outside her comfort range and read short books instead of long books, which she does and discovers that she also likes poetry and nonfiction and lots of other things. But she's so relieved at the end because she finds she can go back to the kinds of books that she really liked. And I kept thinking about the Kelsey Greens of the world when I was doing this.
Yeah, so this is for them. You know?
This is absolutely for them.
Because that lifelong love of reading, that spark, you know, has to be sparked early in mm-hmm. most cases. But although if it happens later, then you know, whenever it happens, it's a good thing when it happens. I wonder, is Harry Potter just a complete sort of sui generis, you know, unique thing? I mean, the fact that it was such a phenomenon, it's obviously a series, and what were there, like 8 of those, I think, something like that, 7. Has that done anything to raise, lower, or change the bar for literature for young
Absolutely.
Readers?
Absolutely. There is no question that Harry Potter completely changed the picture. The author of Harry Potter, changed what people looked at as appropriate books for children. She absolutely made fantasy possible, and she turned all kinds of kids on to reading. So not every early eager reader is reading Harry Potter, but most of them do. But the feeling of carrying that great big book around says, I'm a reader.
I'm a reader. I'm a grown-up. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, Kathy Isaacs, this is a lot of fun and very helpful for parents and teachers. Appreciate you coming by and talking about it.
I love reading books. It's fun. I often read them with my mom. I like reading to explore. There's no better way, I'm sure. I love reading.
Kathleen Isaacs, her very helpful resource is called Excellent Books for Early and Eager Readers. It's published by the American Library Association. We've got a link to more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. This is Maryland Morning. You want to hear more from us? We'd certainly love to hear from you. You can follow us on Twitter at Maryland Morning, and you can send me a tweet at Tom Hall, WYPR. That's it for us today. Coming up Wednesday, join us for another installment of the Accountability Index, our monthly series of conversations with reporters from the online investigative daily, The Baltimore Brew, plus two very imaginative philanthropists, Ruby Lerner and Jane Brown, join me to talk about how artists can transform communities and the ways in which artists can be supported to do the kind of work that only they can do. And Baltimore writer Benjamin Warner will stop by to talk about his new novel, Thirst. That's all coming up Wednesday morning on Maryland Morning. Writer's Almanac is up next. For Nathan Sterner and the entire Maryland Morning team, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.